This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with an attorney and an activist for two different perspectives on the white supremacist protests in Charlottesville, Virginia.
It turned out to be a tremendous victory for the anti-fascist forces in the United States.
Donald Trump has promised fire and fury like the world has never seen. The potential for armed conflict between the United States and North Korea has remained since the armistice of 1953.
That war never ended. Only an armistice was signed. It could bubble over at any moment, including into a nuclear war.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Donald Trump and his extreme right supporters, outright fascists, white nationalists, suffered a huge defeat on August 12th in Charlottesville, Virginia, at a rally called Unite the Right. Anti-fascist demonstrator, 32-year-old Charlottesville paralegal Heather Heyer, was murdered by a car driven by a Nazi sympathizer from Ohio named James Alex Fields. 19 other counter-demonstrators were also injured, some seriously. As a consequence of the murder and injuries, the white nationalists and fascists were socially isolated, even as the United Left welcomed support from a large swath of Americans. Demonstrations were held in many cities and towns across the country after that. People jeered President Trump at his first New York City homecoming. Hundreds gathered at Trump Tower, which was protected by many police and 12 garbage trucks. After the murder, he blamed both sides for the violence at Charlottesville. Some 500 white national forces came together in Charlottesville, intending to violently suppress their opponents. They unified around the support to keep a statue of Confederate general and slave owner Robert E. Lee, who led the Southern Army from 1861 until 1865, when he finally surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant. The South had lost its fight to preserve slavery, and more than 600,000 Americans died in that war, more than the combined total of all deaths in all subsequent wars. Yet the ultra-right still embraces this lost cause. We speak today with Charlottesville attorney Jeff Fogel, and then with Chicago anti-fascist organizer and educator John Karinsky. Jeffrey Fogel has practiced criminal law for many years. He served as legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights before moving to Charlottesville, where he recently ran for district attorney. He was on the scene as a National Lawyers Guild attorney on August 12th. We first speak with Jeff Fogel. Jeff, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
We're talking to you from your law office in Charlottesville, Virginia, several days after the, quote, Unite the Right events in your town. Tell us what things are like there now.
Well, I think today is a day there's going to be a memorial service for the woman who was murdered by that Nazi with his vehicle. And so I think a lot of people are anticipating that and expressing their own sadness about that today and the other people who were injured. For the last couple days, I think people have been sort of a little bit in disbelief. As much as we knew about what was coming, I don't think people anticipated the results that occurred. So I think people were a little bit in shock and very saddened by the harm that was created to not just the individuals, but to the community as well. And I think, but at the same time, resolute in opposing anything like this coming back here, and opposing people here in the community that might share those views.
I understand that on Saturday you were a National Lawyers Guild legal observer. Can you describe for us what the role of the police was like?
Well, it was, you have to say what the role of the police wasn't like. When I got downtown, which was early, the protesters were supposed to gather, the Nazis were supposed to gather in a park, and that left the main street of the city, Market Street, open to counter-protesters. So when I was observing, after people were entering the park, the ralliers, some fights ensued. First off, the ralliers apparently were supposed to have entered the park through the rear, but somehow dodged the police and entered through the front where all the counter-protesters were, which made absolutely no sense. Then after some fights broke out, people were swinging sticks and bats and throwing water bottles filled with urine, balloons filled with cement, balloons filled with dye, with smoke bombs, with mace, and so on. And as this is going on right at the corner of the entrance to that park, the police are just standing there watching. And in this instance, we're talking about the state police, and there were three or four of them right adjacent to where I was standing who just stood there and watched. People yelled at them. They had no reaction whatsoever. So we saw that transpire for a period of time, they say very short. It wasn't that short. A lot of people got hurt in that context, and not just people who were engaged in the fights, but innocent people as well. I saw the clergy who had come and had stood at one of the entrances just get pushed aside by the Nazis as they entered the park, and the police just stood there. Now, eventually, the police declared it an unlawful assembly and had already set up riot squad within the park to push people out. And that was the second decision that one had to question, because having had these folks confined in the park, they pushed them out right into the street in front of the park where all the counter-protesters were as well, and more hell broke loose. Now, thereafter, these folks who had been in the park, the neo-Nazis, the Ku Klux Klanners, the white supremacists, started roving around in bands around town. And although there was a state police helicopter that was supposed to be following them, people were beaten up. There was a young man who was beaten up in the parking garage. They attempted to get to a low-income housing project, but people came out and stood them down. Well, we all know about the incident where the guy drove his car into a crowd of people in an attempt to murder as many as he could. And there were other incidents as well where the police never got to intervene in any respect. So I don't know what they claim their tactic to have been that day, but apparently it was, we're not going to put any of our police officers in danger by putting them in the middle of this group of people who are fighting. But again, as I said, that left what seemed to be the disorder part of law and disorder going on in the middle of the streets, and we're sitting there watching it, and there's absolutely nothing we can do.
Jeff, how did that contrast to the role of the police last month at the KKK rally?
Right. Well, that's what was so striking about it, because the KKK rally, they came out in force right away. They insisted on escort and actually housing in their own garage the vehicles that the Ku Klux Klan came in. They then formed a phalanx around them as they entered in order to enter the park. Of course, previously they had dragged about a half a dozen people out who were nonviolently blocking the entrance to the park. And so they entered the park. They were surrounded by police. They were encompassed by barricades. And then there was a buffer zone where the press were allowed to go. And then there was another barricade where the counter-protesters were. And the police were very, very clear that those Ku Klux Klansmen were going, and women, I think, were going to get to have their rally as they wanted it, where they wanted it, and to say what they wanted to. Of course, they didn't get to say much of anything because the crowd shouted them down. But thereafter, when the crowd followed the police who were escorting the Ku Klux Klan out of town, the police came out in very heavy riot gear. And started to declare every group of people that was out in the street after the Klan left to be an unlawful assembly, and then started tear gassing people long after the Klan was gone just because they wouldn't listen to their orders to disperse when the street was closed and there was no reason to disperse. So there was a lot of criticism of the police and the militarization of the police, the uniforms they were using, the armored vehicles that were out on, you know, in force, and the, you know, assault rifles that were on the shoulders of the state police riot gear as well. So there was a lot of criticism of that. And I don't know whether the city was supposedly reacting to that criticism by trying to stand down, but it was also open question, I think, for a lot of people as to who was in charge here, whether it was the local police department or whether it was the state police under the direction of the governor and the director of public safety who was here also monitoring the situation. And nobody's really saying. The local police claimed they were in charge, but you didn't see very many of them. And if they were in charge, they were communicating their commands from afar. So that's one question that has to be answered. The other question is, Why did they start with the tactics, the heavy militarized tactics in the first instance when it was totally unnecessary, and then back off of anything on the second instance when it was necessary?
What has been in the news, splashed all over the papers and TV, is who was responsible for the violence. Trump, in his latest third statement, August 14th, again blamed both sides. What's your assessment of when you place the onus for the violence, who would you place it on?
Well, Michael, that's a very broad question. I mean, this is a society steeped in violence and steeped in racism. There's no absence of people to accuse of being responsible for this, going back to the founding of the country and slavery and Jim Crow, and here the destruction of the black community in, as in many places, during urban renewal, and the continued oppression of black people through the criminal justice system and so on. So you have a strain of racism that has existed in this country, obviously, since the beginning. It's never been eliminated. As somebody said at a memorial service the other night, not a memorial, as a service before this, we never did cut the head of racism off. We may have made some incisions, but we never fully cut it off, and this is what remains and has been allowed to remain. Now, at the same time, you can say the police have some responsibility for not having intervened. The local newspaper accused the one black councilman who had called for the removal of the Confederate statue at the park and held him responsible for it. Now, that's bizarre. He didn't cause any of that. He simply said what he thought was should have happened, and many people in this town agreed with him, and that's it. So I don't know that you can point the finger at any one particular person, but certainly, and it wasn't the Antifa who brought this on us, it was they and Black Lives Mattered who actually protected people.
Yeah, no, I was speaking, I was referring to what happened on that Saturday and the confrontations, because it seems to me that the ultra-rightists, the white nationalists and the white supremacists and so on, they came looking for a fight.
Oh, there's no doubt about that, with the weaponry and the shields and everything else, and with their taunting comments and their refusal to follow the agreement that they had, apparently even to enter the back of the park, so that they could confront the people, the Antifas, in front of the park. So, yes, that's clear. Nobody else after this rally was running around town beating on people. It was them. So if there's a responsibility among the parties that were present that day in what used to be Lee Park, it clearly had been the so-called Unite the Right ralliers.
Jeff, I understand that while you were running for district attorney, you were arrested this June 4th, and you had an altercation with one of the organizers of the Unite the Right demonstration. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, just a little background. This one gentleman has been a bane of contention here in Charlottesville. He claims he's not a supremacist. He's just a white nationalist, and he's the one who helped organize this rally. And he named it, I think, Unity and Strength as well. That's the name of his organization. There have been verbal altercations going on here for months with him, and particularly with a group called Showing Up for Racial Justice. And they have confronted him as he's come out to the downtown mall, which is the principal pedestrian area here, and called him out for what he is, as a fascist and a Nazi. They had also been complaining to restaurants at the mall about not serving him. And a number of those restaurants decided they wouldn't serve him given what he stood for. Now, one night I was called down to observe an incident in which this guy and some associates of his were having dinner on the downtown mall, and people from Surge, that's Showing Up for Racial Justice, were there to protest. And they basically got up with signs, just signs that said, Nazi, go home. They waited until he had gotten a receipt for the food or drink that they had had, and they had confronted him in that silent, peaceful manner. Of course, the people at that table started shouting back and forth. This gentleman, who is typically goes around trying to provoke people, he sticks his cell phone in your face, taking video and calls you names and so on. At some point, after he was going around, he came over to where I was seated. I was actually eating dinner at the time, and started shouting at me as here's the local Commonwealth attorney. He's a communist. We have got to build that wall, and he should be the first one over it. And me, probably stupidly got up to confront him and said, you know, hey, man, why don't you just get a job, do something productive, because everybody knows that he lives with his mother and doesn't work. At that point, he started calling me a communist shithole in my face, and then another guy stuck his head into basically almost touching my face, yelling at me, you communist, at which point I put my hand on his chest and just held him back. They then started screaming, oh, my friend was assaulted, and in Virginia, it doesn't take much to constitute an assault. Any unwanted touching constitutes an assault. So they eventually went down to the police station. I decided to follow and tell my side of the story. When I got there, I got into an argument with the sergeant, who claimed to have a video of me assaulting this person, and he wouldn't show it to me. I then left. At 12:30 in the morning, five police cars showed up to arrest me. The police had gone to the magistrate. The magistrate said he wanted to issue a summons. This is what I'm told. The police said, no, this guy's bad. You're going to have him arrested. And so the magistrate issued an arrest warrant, and five cops came at 12:30 in the morning to arrest me and take me to the jail where the magistrate was. And, you know, after some period of time of having mugshots and fingerprints and all of that, I was released on a $5,000 personal security bond. One, by the way, that wouldn't even let me leave the state of Virginia. I had to go to a higher judge to get that release so I could go to the Guild Convention in Washington. So that's where it stands there. A local prosecutor doesn't want to prosecute me, partly because I was running against them for office. And so they've got to find a special prosecutor, and they're having a little trouble finding somebody else to prosecute the case. And right now we're scheduled for September 29th, so we'll see. But, you know, I wasn't the only one. This had happened to a client of mine 2 days before, who they came and arrested her with five police cars and took her down to be arrested for a very, very minor disorderly conduct charge. So there's been some fight back, I would say, or some pushback from the police department. And I don't know how far this goes, and I'm not sure how much they're going to tell me as a result of their investigation. But surely there were people in the police department who either didn't like me because of my previous criticisms of the police or because of what I was saying in the district attorney race or because of what I got into an argument with in the police station. And the magistrate, who I confronted, said the reason he issued the arrest warrant and not a summons because he didn't like the way I spoke to the sergeant in the police department. So that's the subject of a complaint, too.
Yeah, I wanted to just point out, because we forgot to mention, the man that did this to you is named Jason Kessler. Jason Kessler. He's one of the organizers of last Saturday's Unite the Right. And he told the Associated Press, when they asked him about what was going on, he said, this is about an anti-white climate within the Western world and the need for white people to have advocacy like other groups. So right. This guy takes a stance that he and other white people are victims.
Oh, no, no, that's been his posture, is that he's a victim. In fact, he got very upset because at one point in the press I referred to him as a crybaby. That's all he was going around. And he was very upset. He actually called me that day in the afternoon, and with a sort of whiny voice, he said, that wasn't fair, calling me a crybaby. And I said, let me play back what you just said to me and see if you could have a third party listen and let them say whether you're a crybaby or not. But that upset him a lot. And he's been yelling at me ever since then.
Jeff, what has been the history over the dispute about removing the statue of Robert E. Lee from the main park in Charlottesville?
Well, first of all, let me say I've only been here 11 years, so I can't speak to the history because this monument was put up in 1924. It was donated as part of this one block park by a gentleman who donated some land here but was also a racist and also ensured that only white people were allowed to use that park. We've seen pictures of the installation, and there are Klansmen and others around cheering. There was a period of time in the South, I think in the 1920s, when a strong feeling of the lost cause came back, and a lot of statues were put up at that time. We had two of them, one of them being General Lee in Lee Clark, the other being Stonewall Jackson in what's called Johnson Park. I didn't hear much about it. Obviously, it stood out. I mean, this is a monster statue in a one-block park. I mean, it dominates the entire park, and it's the only park in downtown Charlottesville. So I'm sure people have talked about it over the years. I certainly know the people that I know who lived here during, Jim Crow, about how they felt about that, particularly since it was one of the places they were not allowed to go. But more recently, I would say about 4 or 5 years ago, a student at the high school who started the Black Student Union put together a petition to remove that Confederate statue, and it gathered some traction in town. At that point, two counselors, one black, one white, came out and said they think it no longer represents what Charlottesville stands for and that it should be moved. Of course, a major controversy ensued. There was a commission appointed, a so-called Blue Ribbon Commission on Monuments and Memorials. They held numerous public meetings. Hundreds and hundreds of people came out, argued on both sides of the issue, the so-called people who care about history, and that this is somehow moving a statue is the destruction of history, which I still don't understand, and of course those of us who were in favor of removing the statue. I have to tell you, frankly, I was not very strong feeling about this initially, feeling that, you know, we've got to focus our attention on the problems of today. But as I talk to more and more people in the community, particularly in the black community, who have felt the sort of oppression of Lee dominating the entire downtown and the history of racism that goes back, you know, as everybody knows, to slave days here, and had to be more sensitive to the feelings the black people had. And there was no reason to keep this monument. There's no reason particularly to destroy it. It should go in some museum, perhaps. But it certainly was time for a new narrative. Whether it's the narrative that the city council might want to put in, I might disagree with, but certainly not the narrative that that is reflected in that statute from 1924.
Well, Jeff, they are certainly fortunate to have you down there in Charlottesville, Virginia, and we would like to stay in touch. We really appreciate your joining us today.
Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
No problem. Thank you all.
That was Jeff Fogel from Charlottesville, Virginia. We now speak with John Karinsky from Chicago.
John Karinsky is a Chicago anti-fascist organizer and educator. He recently gave a speech on the topic of fighting the right at the Socialism 2017 conference in Chicago, which had a record attendance of more than 2,000 people.
John Karinsky, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
John, how large was the ultra-right gathering in Charlottesville on August 12th, and what groups were involved there?
You know, so many groups attended, it would take a while to get through all of them. So I think I'll do a bit of a greatest hits. You know, the rally was called by a guy named Jason Kessler, who's a right-wing blogger. Richard Spencer from the National Policy Institute was there. Matthew Heimbach with the Traditionalist Workers Party out of Kentucky. A lawyer from Florida named Augustus Invictus, who's an occultist libertarian, member of a street fighting group called the American Guard, the Fraternal Order of the Alt Knights, the Proud Boys, Identity Europa, a white nationalist group that organizes on college campuses, as well as some older right-wing organizations. You know, the Klan was there, the League of the South is the largest neo-Confederate organization, and a couple of explicitly neo-Nazi groups, including the National Socialist Movement. So estimates vary, but there were probably around 700 to 1,000 people on the side of the far right present in Charlottesville last Saturday.
John, I'm just curious. I can't imagine being around the Klan. Did they dress in their usual garb?
They did, yes. You had people in the Klan robes matching their rank, you know, so people in white robes and red robes. There are some absolutely stunning pictures of protesters, you know, screaming in the faces of Klan members that are holding, you know, batons and weapons. It's really shocking to see these images in 2017.
And how about the counter-protesters?
The counter-protesters probably also, the estimates vary, there were probably a similar matchup in terms of numbers, 700 to 1,000. They're from a very wide range of organizations, anti-racist clergy, religious groups, congregations, a bunch of organizations that were formed during the Black Lives Matter movement. There were socialist and anarchist organizations, and many, many unaffiliated anti-racist and anti-fascist, you know, young people and community members who had either from Charlottesville itself or from towns and cities nearby who had driven in to protest the far right.
Who came out victorious, and how would you define that?
So I think despite the really evenly matched numbers, and as difficult as it is to describe a confrontation that results in the death of an anti-racist and serious injury to many others, I think that if you look at what happened on balance, it's hard to deny that the far right has been set back. You know, I've described the capacity of the far right to grow as being based in this moment on rhetoric around victimhood and persecution. So they say, you know, the anti-fascist youth and the liberal professors and the media elites, they're trying to take away our rights and to hurt us. And that narrative has collapsed because they ran over 19 people with a car. You know, that's not free speech, it's murder. It's undeniable and everyone knows this. And so now liberal organizations, which previously might have raised disagreements with the idea of directly confronting the far right, or maybe wondering, you know, are they really Nazis? Are they really the Klan? Are these people sympathizers to these, you know, far right extreme ideologies? Some of these people have been coming out to rallies in solidarity with the left in Charlottesville and supporting the idea of confronting the right. So it's the start of a shift, and it has everything to do with the far right's victimhood narrative collapsing. And so we've seen some things as a result of this. For a small but significant number of people whose main engagement with the far right in their audience was online, you know, this attack provoked a crisis. It's no more fun and games. Someone's been killed, and it's an act of terrorism, and everyone knows it. So some sympathizers have publicly recanted their views. You can go on the far right internet forums, and you see people debating each other about, you know, how do we avoid situations like this in the future? So they know that they've messed up in a big way. You know, but there's a long way to go to really isolate them, and things can go backwards. They're planning rallies in a number of cities. They're trying to spin the attack in a way that will be able to pull people back into sympathizing towards them. It's a loss for the far right. I wish it was more of a loss. I wish we'd been able to fill the streets with, you know, 10,000 to their 1,000. I wish we'd been able to get to a point where even the very idea of violence against our side wasn't a possibility. And, of course, you know, I think we all wish that Heather Heyer were still alive. But nevertheless, you know, the far right's violence stands on full display, and there's no going back to the situation that we were in just last week.
Many people, both Trump supporters and his detractors, reacted to his first public statement after the violent attacks on the counter-demonstrators. One far-right website said he refused to even mention anything to do with us. Another racist website gloated when reporters were screaming at him about white nationalism, he just walked out of the room. What happened after Trump's first, I would say, weasel-worded condemnation of the violence? Can you give us an update?
Sure, yes. So, you know, we had a sequence of statements over the last few days. First, there were these tweets saying that he condemns both sides. And then after a bunch of pressure, I think his advisors wrote, mostly for him, wrote a statement that he issued that, you know, began to kind of condemn white supremacists and the murder of this woman, Heather Heyer, and to say, to move in the direction of calling this an act of terrorism. And then he issued a third statement yesterday, just an astoundingly awful statement that doubled down on the condemning both sides rhetoric. It used the term alt-left and compared the defensive violence of the left to the right driving a car into a crowd of people. And he goes on for a couple of minutes about, you know, oh, they're not all Nazis. There's some good people on the side of the people who wanted to keep the statue in the park and so on. Okay, so, you know, since Sunday, his approval rating has dropped 2 points. He's now at an all-time low. The polls haven't come in yet. I think he's going to drop again and set a new record for low polling for a presidential candidate. It's just astounding. The president of the United States on national television saying, in a battle between people who are more or less explicit Nazis, Klan members on the one side, and anti-racists on the other, well, you know, both sides are wrong. Some of the people marching with Nazis were nice, good people. You know, and we have a term in our movement for that kind of equivocation, and it's Nazi sympathizer. You know, it's just, even if you're like a dog whistle racist Republican, this is something that in American politics in 2017 you just don't do. It's against the rules of presidential rhetoric. So most of his board of consultative CEOs that were going to help him with the infrastructure bill, they've quit. And it looks like Trump is more isolated than ever. And now anti-racism and anti-fascism are the central issue in American politics.
John, I just want to ask, you referred to the term defensive violence by some on the left. What would you say to those who point out, well, it may not have all been defensive? What do you say about what I think is a small minority of individuals? Could there be agents provocateur
Well, that's a great question. I think it's entirely possible that there's provocation, but I think we have to start by looking at the context. So, you know, some of the militia groups are coming out, you know, with AR-15s and, you know, heavy assault weapons on the part of the far right, and almost everyone on the far right is showing up with some sort of small, you know, a baton or a club or a cane or something like that. And so, you know, it's normal in situations like this for the left to show up ready to make sure that people aren't going to be injured. And that means bringing, you know, a wooden shield or something else to protect yourself from the right. Because, you know, one thing that you see in these kinds of demonstrations is that the police really don't do a very good job of doing that. It seems they're not really that interested in doing it. And so, you know, people come there ready to defend themselves. And part of that defense can also mean being prepared to be able to push them back if they want to surround someone and you know, physically assault and hurt them. As we saw, one young man was bludgeoned under an overpass by several right-wingers. They ganged up on him. And so I think in that context, you can understand why some people may want to go in from the left with, you know, a club or a baton. There's always provocation. There will always be undercover police officers that are trying to incite things. But I think it's important to look at this stuff in the context of, you know, there's some people on our side with wooden shields and with batons, I think for very good reasons. And then there's someone who drives, you know, a two-ton piece of metal at 40 miles an hour into a crowd of people.
People have been galvanized after seeing that all across the country. Can you talk about that, please?
Yes, totally. So, you know, I think now that anti-racism and anti-fascism, at least for the moment, are the central issue in U.S. politics, you know, as opposed to, like, this manufactured nonsense about Russia and hacking, it's beginning to allow for really large numbers of people to come into motion, sort of like the first couple of months after the election, or at least there's that potential. So, you know, people were outraged and shocked and in mourning after the attack over the weekend, which is so undeniably, you know, a terrorist attack perpetrated by the far right. And it's very clear to people that the president and, you know, the Justice Department and the state and the police, they're not going to do much about it. And so, you know, especially it seems clear the police won't in the era of, you know, so-called Blue Lives Matter. So it's much clearer to a bigger layer of people that if we're going to stop the far right, we have to do it ourselves. And that means large numbers of people. That's a really positive development because the movement against the far right has, for a period of time, been somewhat small. You know, we saw the large rallies on the West Coast and then, you know, in Chicago when Trump came to speak here during his campaign. But then, you know, The movement was led for a period of time by anti-fascist youth in pretty small numbers, and that led to a loss of public support for anti-fascism. But now the weekend sort of breathed new life. So we've had liberal organizations coming in, injecting lots of new ideas and numbers and energy into that movement. That raises all kinds of questions, which always happens when a movement explodes into being, but it's very exciting and promising, and it shows the potential to really, you know, isolate the far right in a much more permanent way if we can figure out how to organize some really large demonstrations in response to the next couple of Charlottesvilles.
John, I'm just curious. We all comment that Trump has emboldened white supremacists across the nation. Do you think it was a reaction to having an African-American president and then this extreme opposite? Is it a larger problem than many of us, especially in the Northeast, are aware of?
I think the hardcore of the racist far right is a pretty small chunk of the overall population of the United States. I think you're right to point to the 8 years of Obama, you know, and there being a racist reaction to Obama's presidency that began to develop there. But the history of organized white supremacy in this country, as you and many of your listeners know, goes much farther back than that. I think that you also have to look at the fact that the economy has been in a state of crisis since 2009, you know, and that's affected working class people in a certain sort of way. Of course, you know, corporate profits have recovered while wages have not really recovered in a serious way, but it's also affected middle class people who had, you know, aspirations to move into a profession or maybe to be in the same kind of income bracket as their parents. And that might not be possible despite getting a college degree, you know, in quite the same way that it used to be. So you have a lot of people who had certain aspirations and then had those aspirations dashed. And then, you know, people who are, you know, social climbers want to climb the social ladder. There's a tendency to want to blame the people below you on the social ladder. And so, you know, I think there's this idea that the far right that exists. We saw people coming out to demonstrations over the weekend with signs that using language to indicate, oh, the Klan and the far right, these are kind of hill people, or, you know, they use the term rednecks, which I don't really like that much. And, you know, I think it's really a misperception. If you saw the pictures of the Torchlight rally on Friday night, of the Richard Spencer's followers carrying the tiki torches, of all things, these, you know, patio candles that they bought to march around outside on the university campus, they're wearing these Fred Perry polo shirts and boat shoes. You know, it looks like they're about to go out, you know, on the lake on their dad's sailboat. And so I don't think we're talking about, again, I don't like this term, but, you know, hillbillies or poor whites. We're talking about middle-class people. And so, you know, I think their numbers are small right now, but the objective conditions that allowed them to begin to gain in confidence during the election season and now, those conditions still exist. So that we may be able to push them back organizationally, we've got to do something about those objective conditions if we're going to be able to defeat them in the long run.
What's the goal of the far right?
That's a great question. So I think the best and the smartest leaders of the far right, they're mainly just trying to grow their own ranks. And so, you know, for Spencer, this means ideological training in a tradition of far right theory and history. Or at least he likes to say ideological training because he wants to disavow the violence, especially the individual terror that happens in the name of his movement. They want to kind of gain a profile that they can use to recruit people to their groups through acts of terror and intimidation. They prefer that it be collective rather than individual terror, you know, driving the left out of the streets, saying, you know, doing demonstrations to kind of defeat the Black Lives Matter movement and to drive it off the streets, and to give their people a sense of being part of something that has a certain kind of momentum over against a common enemy. And they face a certain kind of bind in this, which is that, you know, all the smartest leaders of the far right oppose individual terror as a tactic because they know it isolates them and it ruins the victimhood narrative. But in order to maintain their standing in their organizations, they have to use rhetoric and do things that vastly increase the likelihood of individual terror via the ideas they're spreading. So the overreach that we saw in Charlottesville when this far-right terrorist drove a car into a group of people, we're going to see, unfortunately, I think, more things like that. The far right can denounce it all they like, but, you know, it's going to keep happening. And if our side can figure out how to take advantage of the political openings that are created when they overstep and when they break down their persecution victim narrative, that's going to really help us isolate them. But that bind isn't going to be enough to totally sink the ship. As I said, we've got to, you know, take advantage of the openings that are created when that persecution narrative collapses. And then we also have to do something about the objective conditions that push people towards the far right in the first place.
We've been talking with John Kerensky, who's an anti-fascist organizer in Chicago. John, what kind of alternative politics do we need to put forward in response to the far right's despair?
Yes, great question. So, you know, put really simply, where they advance politics of fear and division, we have to be for solidarity and unity. You know, where they want to scapegoat an oppressed group, we've got to point out the real problem, which is that we have a society organized around the pursuit of profit rather than meeting human needs, which is why so many people are as miserable as they are. And so, you know, it's not enough, though, to just kind of propagandistically say we need solidarity, we need a society that's not based on profit. We actually have to figure out how to get, you know, the social forces capable of realizing that kind of society to go into motion. If the working class movement and the trade unions begin to fight, and if we had a political party in this country that was committed to pursuing that project, that could show an alternate path out of the crisis of the crisis of the system that began in 2008, that could pull along some of these middle class people that otherwise are in the kind of broad periphery of the far right. So we have to, you know, build organizations that stand for an alternative to this society, but also try to create a fight to realize that society on a much broader scale. And that's the only way in the long run we're going to be able to defeat them.
John, talk about the unity of the left and what's going on now to increase and broaden it. I noticed that the International Socialist Organization and the Democratic Socialists of America and the IWW had all come together at these protests. What kind of organizing is going on now to broaden and bring people together on the left?
Sure, yes. So the response has just been incredible over the weekend. In cities and towns all over the country, there were vigils and protests in solidarity with the counter-protesters in Charlottesville organized within hours. You know, some of them on Saturday night and then some on Sunday. So the three organizations you mentioned, the DSA, the ISO, and the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, they'd co-organized demonstrations in a number of big cities alongside some other socialist groups that played a positive role. That's partly because of who was there in Charlottesville. You know, ISO and IWW comrades were among those seriously injured in the attack. And those demonstrations, co-sponsored by those groups, brought out collectively thousands all over the country. So it's a really healthy display of unity of action among the socialist left that we absolutely have to build on. You know, and these groups disagree about all kinds of things, and that's okay. But what matters is that there's an emerging agreement. You know, in full disclosure, I'm active with the ISO. There's an emerging agreement that in this moment, we have to make utterly outnumbering and humiliating the fascist far-right priority number one. It's a matter of self-defense for not just the organizations of the socialist left, but for the labor movement and social movements as a whole. But it's really important also that this unity goes beyond the radical left. So some of the new, you know, resistance formations that sprang up after the election have called and attended demonstrations. Here in Chicago, the organizers of the January 21st Women's March, which was one of the largest marches in U.S. history, they used their platform to bring people out. And another group called Indivisible that kind of came out of the Sanders campaign called a rally. So if we can bring together the socialist left with some of those forces in the next few weeks, I think we can do big things. And there's a whole lot to be done. There are other far-right rallies and events coming up. Some of them could be major confrontations. One of those, August 27th in Berkeley, a number of far-right groups have called a demonstration called, you know, No to Marxism in America, with the idea that, you know, I guess they think we had a socialist president in Barack Obama or something wacky like that. And so, you know, that's going to be a major confrontation like Charlottesville. They're going to be bringing in people from the far-right all over the country. So there's talk of organizing a national anti-fascist day of action for the 27th, with rallies in cities all over the country to show just how isolated and marginal these people are. You know, imagine, they bring all of their forces to one city, and we mobilize not just in that city, but in every city all over the country to reject everything they stand for and to demand, you know, that Trump really clearly denounce and distance himself from them forever. Kick Bannon, kick Gorka out of his administration. It could be a really transformative moment. We don't have a lot of time. The next couple of weeks are going to be really important if we're going to be able to push these people back into the shadows.
John, how can listeners learn about what you're doing, get in touch with you, or join in the mobilization?
Yes. So I don't use Twitter, unfortunately, but people are welcome to friend me on follow me on Facebook. Just search my name, John Kurinsky. And, of course, I think there will probably be press releases. Hopefully there will be a coalition coming together in Chicago, but also in other cities all over the country. There's a coalition based in Berkeley that's going to help put together, I think, the National Day of Action. That coalition is called Unite for Freedom from Right-Wing Violence. And the URL is a mouthful, but it's facebook.com/ Unite for Freedom from Right-Wing Violence. No spaces. And if you go to that URL, it's a Facebook fan page, and you can like it and follow it, and they're going to be posting updates about the gathering of counter-protesters in Berkeley and what people can do around the country to show their solidarity.
John, thank you so much for your activism and your enthusiasm, and it's always great to touch base with you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You take it easy, John. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
President Donald Trump scared the hell out of us with his threat to nuclear bomb North Korea. He promised fire and fury like the world has never seen. The next day, he doubled down, stating North Korea better get their act together or they're going to be in trouble like few nations have ever been in trouble. It may very well be tougher than I said. He said this at the time of the 72nd anniversary of the U.S. nuclear bombing of the Japanese city of Hiroshima, and then 6 days later, the Japanese city of Nagasaki. This was done not to stop the war, which was coming to an end, but to scare the Russians. These two nuclear bombings killed some 160,000 persons instantaneously, and tens of thousands died later of nuclear poisoning. So far, this has been the only time nuclear bombs have ever been used. The United States had previously been at war with North Korea from 1950 to 1953. 3.5 million North Koreans were killed and the country laid waste. The war never ended, but an armistice was signed in 1953. North Korea began its nuclear program in self-defense after George W. Bush in 2004 named it along with Iraq and Iran as part of what he called, quote, the Axis of Evil. Then Bush started the war against Iraq, captured and executed its leader, Saddam Hussein, and destroyed a viable country, killing over 1 million Iraqis and scattering refugees across the world. Here to talk with us about the current United States-North Korea situation is Richard Becker. He recently authored an analytical article for Liberation, the newspaper of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. The article is titled, Trump Threatens the Nuclear Annihilation of North Korea and the DRRK Will Not Blink.
Richard Becker, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much, Heidi.
In a nutshell, if you will, can you please recount the history of U.S.-North Korean relations since the armistice of 1953?
Yeah, I think if we just take a step back from that, too, at the end of World War II and the end of the Japanese colonial control of Korea, Korea was divided along the 38th parallel with U.S. forces in the south and Soviet forces and Korean guerrilla forces in the north. In 1948, the Soviet forces withdrew. The U.S. never withdrew. And in 1950 to 1953 was the Korean War, where around 4 million, that's the estimate, 4 to 4.5 million Koreans, mostly civilians, were killed. The armistice came about because although the U.S. forces had largely been defeated, President Eisenhower told the Korean leadership and the Chinese leadership at the time that if they didn't sign an armistice, that the U.S. would drop nuclear weapons on the major population centers of both Korea and China and create a line along the Yalu River, where Korea and Manchuria meet, that would be a zone that was destroyed for centuries by radiation. So they signed the treaty, they signed the armistice, but there's never been a peace treaty. The Korean War, really, technically speaking, and more than technically speaking, continues till today. The hostility of the U.S. toward North Korea has been unrelenting. In 1995, Colin Powell said that if North Korea took any action the U.S. didn't like, they would turn North Korea into a quote-unquote charcoal briquette. In 2001, when George W. Bush came in, one of his top foreign policy advisors, John Bolton, was asked the question, what's your policy on North Korea? His response was, no North Korea. And so in 2002, in his State of the Union message, George W. Bush called Iran, Iraq, and North Korea the axis of evil. This is a ludicrous term. It was meant to invoke in the minds of people in the United States the axis powers, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the others from World War II. And there was no basis for that. But the year after he made that speech, the U.S. invaded and destroyed Iraq. It was then that North Korea and the Soviet Union had fallen, years earlier. People had expected at that time, there was a widespread expectation that North Korea would fall too. But it didn't. It continued. It went through a lot of hardship. And when Iraq happened, the response of the North Koreans was to put their nuclear program into high gear, and clearly as a defensive program, which as it has always been. So we've seen this pattern over the years of in the spring and in the fall. Every year, the U.S. and South Korean forces conduct military maneuvers. They're starting again next Monday, and they are aimed at rehearsing for the invasion of North Korea and what the generals openly call a decapitation strategy against the North Korean leadership. I think that's some of the critical context for looking at the present situation.
That's very useful, Richard. Are you saying that the mass media's depiction of North Korea as a threat or a so-called rogue state is not accurate?
Well, I would say that if we want to talk about rogue states, we got to start with the United States. No one else has bases all over the world. No one else has conducted literally hundreds of interventions, wars, occupations, covert actions over the last 70 years that the United States has carried out. And clearly, the North Korean leadership knows and has known, not just the present leadership, but the previous leadership as well, that if they launched a war against South Korea or Japan, that the response would be overwhelming, that they would be annihilated by the far superior nuclear power and conventional power of the United States. I think there's no question that it's a deterrent and that we have been propagandized by the mainstream media, as always in times of war crisis, in a way that completely misrepresents the reality of the situation.
You think it might be those nuclear weapons would be a deterrent to use, not through the air, but on the ground?
I think that the reality of the situation is that the deterrent up until now, until recently, has been that North Korea has very strong conventional forces, or at least it's said. I mean, they don't measure up to the U.S., of course, but that if the U.S. launched a war on North Korea, that North Korea would hit back at South Korea and at the 28 bases the U.S. maintains in South Korea. There's still an occupation of that country, would hit back at U.S. bases in Japan. But now with the development, the higher technological development of North Korea with nuclear weapons and missiles, the idea has circulated in U.S. circles that they don't need to worry about that because the people will be dying over there, not here, and that they must eliminate North Korea's nuclear weapons, which are, as I said before, a deterrent.
What about the new sanctions that the United States got the UN Security Council to pass against North Korea? What are the sanctions? You think they'll have much of an effect?
Well, I don't think that the sanctions are going to change the North Korean policy or their fundamental outlook, but they will cause pain and their suffering for the North Korean people. That's what the sanctions always do. I mean, the U.S. goes around the world sanctioning countries that it sees as standing in the way of its objectives. I was in Iraq twice in the 1990s during the sanctions against Iraq. It was a blockade. 1 million people died, half of them children under the age of 5. Cuba has suffered greatly from the blockade, the sanctions against them. So many countries have suffered, and the leaders know that when they impose sanctions, economic sanctions like the latest ones imposed on North Korea, that it is the population that will suffer, and the idea is to weaken the country. I don't think they have much hope that they bring about regime change. They used to talk about that, you know, quote-unquote regime change. But to weaken the population, to damage the population, to hurt them, in order to try to bring about the achievement of U.S. aims.
The influential U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham recently said, quote, "There is a military option to destroy North Korea's program and North Korea itself." And then he also said that if there is going to be a war to stop Kim Jong-un, it will be over there. If thousands die, they're going to die over there. They're not going to die here. And Trump has told me, to my face, that may be provocative, but not really. When you are a president of the United States, where does your allegiance lie? To the people of the United States. What's your reaction to that statement?
Well, I think it's my reaction to it is it's a monstrous statement. It's a monstrous idea on the part of Graham and Trump and all the others who share this idea that it's okay, you know, to go to war and maybe go to nuclear war against North Korea because the suffering will be in South Korea and Japan and North Korea and among the U.S. bases as well, but the U.S. mainland will not be damaged, or at least they expect that it won't. It's an echo of the Cold War, when the generals and there was a faction all through the 50s and 60s and 70s that kept advocating, let's have nuclear war now against the Soviet Union and China, because they're only going to get stronger and we can defeat them and there'll only be maybe 20 million. I mean, they used to actually calculate this, that maybe there would be 20 million casualties on the U.S. side, but the Soviet Union and the enemies of the United States, as they saw it, would be destroyed. And now we have the same sentiment being put forward in regard to North Korea. But the consequences of a war, even the generals, even Mattis, the so-called Secretary of Defense, has said, if there's a war, it's going to be catastrophic. But that seems to not stand in the way of the calculations of some at the top, including the president.
Richard, has the U.S. practiced invading North Korea?
Yes, and they will begin practicing again on the 21st of August. That's when the new maneuvers begin. These are massive military exercises, they call them, or war games. The thing about war games is you never really know until they're over with, whether they were a quote-unquote game or a practice or whether it's the real thing. They're very close to the border of North Korea. Several hundred thousand South Korean troops and tens of thousands of U.S. troops will practice invasion, beach landings. They talk about the decapitation strategy, cutting off the head of the leadership. And also I have to mention that the B-52s and the B-1 bombers will be again flying from Guam thousands of miles to fly right along the DMZ, imitating bombing raids, bombing attacks on North Korea. This is something the North Koreans have said. If the U.S. would sign a peace treaty and end the Korean War and suspend the exercises, the war games, they will suspend nuclear testing and missile testing. I think that's a reasonable offer from North Korea that could put an end to the current crisis, but the U.S. leadership rejects that out of hand.
Well, what would happen if North Korea gives up its nuclear program and then is invaded by American and South Korea? That's a direct threat to China, its neighbor, right?
Yes, it's a direct threat to, and the reunification of Korea under such circumstances where it was really South Korea took over North Korea, then that takes a U.S. ally and U.S. bases right to the border. I mean, they're very close to the border of China as it is now, being in South Korea, but, you know, that's something that the leadership of the People's Republic of China has never found to be an acceptable idea.
So how dangerous do you believe the situation is now? Has the doomsday clock been advanced?
Well, it has. The Union of Concerned Scientists has advanced it. I think that we all know, and the listeners all know, that there's a very, very adventuristic and unpredictable person who has access to the button, to the football, as they call it, when he travels, and who can launch nuclear war. There's no restraint, which is a very interesting commentary, I think, on democracy and the idea that we have democracy, that he can decide to launch a nuclear war. I mean, there's nothing that is could be of greater consequence to humanity than that, and yet that's left in the hands of one person. I mean, his advisors may try to argue with him about it, but he can really make that order. And if he does make the order would be carried out.
It may sound trivial for me to bring this up, but that kind of unilateral use of American force is against the treaty that the United States signed with the United Nations. It's against the American Constitution. Nonetheless, you have one person that could do that in the name of 330 million people have no say-so in it.
You know, you mentioned, I think you're referring to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. That treaty says that the countries that possess nuclear weapons are supposed to be getting rid of them. That was a treaty signed more than four decades ago, and now we have a plan in place. It was put in place by President Obama to spend $1 trillion over 10 years upgrading or modernizing the nuclear weapons, and Trump wants to throw even more money at that. And so this is really constitutes such a grave danger to humanity and the planet that you can't overstate that. And as you said, you know, it's in the hands of one person, and that is a nullification of democracy in the most fundamental sense.
Richard, on that sobering note, we're going to have to say goodbye because we're running out of time, but we want to thank you so much for your insights on this topic.
Thank you for having me.
Richard Becker, thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.